This is Sprouts Radio.
Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio productions by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location each week.
Like this hand-sized bit of driftwood, sanded, beaten, reshaped, straying from its roots in some distant corner of the world, I stand, always at the mercy of the elements, weather, tide, currents. Who can but wonder that both of us would lose our once pure form? But like it, I have now become my own thing. And like this gnarled shape, yet with a balanced, graceful line, hard, rough, still radiating life, I have too retained the spark, that grain. I pick it up, this driftwood, this thing another man might toss aside as waste. I pick it up, this mojo working its magic, this divining stick, and really dig the power that it brings, because it is my own thing.
I'm Dr. Brooks Robinson of BlackEconomics.org in Honolulu, Hawaii. Today on Sprouts, we learn about the personality whose voice you just heard, the late great poet and scholar of African-American literature, Professor Sarah Webster Fabio, in one of her many, many roles. In this case, a literary expert for the Literary Corner, Black Writers of the World radio program series that was broadcast in the late 1970s. The Literary Corner program is now among the holdings of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. Today we receive special insights about this very unique personality from her daughter, a documentary filmmaker and social activist who also serves as the executive director of the Sarah Webster Fabio Center for Social Justice in Oakland, California. Welcome to Sprouts, Ms. Cheryl Fabio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you, Cheryl, for coming on. As I thought about this interview, after you decided to come on for this interview, one of the first questions that came to mind was this: what were you in the 1970s when your mother was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison as a professor in African-American Studies department and took on this role as a literary expert for the Literary Corner Black Writers of the World program? Where were you at that time?
Probably I was back in California. So in the late 60s, early 70s, I went to Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee. And I did that because my mother is an alumni of Fisk, but also a native of Nashville. So I spent quite a few years in Nashville, I think five, returned home. And, you know, my mother had always been guest lecturing in different locations. And so then she ended up at Wisconsin. And I followed her there. I was there briefly with her, but it's too cold in Wisconsin, so yeah. I came on home.
Yeah. Now, you are a documentary filmmaker and expert on your mother's life and works. Would you just share, if you will, what you think, what do you believe, are her most important literary and scholarly contributions?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to address this. But let me say that, you know, I'm the daughter of, and I'm not being humble, but I am saying I'm not an expert on her career, her literary works. What I'm an expert on is the mother that I had and what I watched growing up as this woman, you know, made a place for herself and also her family in this world. So My take is not necessarily that I've got some literary insight. In fact, you know, I think about the poem that you played in the beginning. That is my favorite poem because, in addition to everything else, so my mother was very worldly in the things that she had to say. But that poem is very intimate. And the side of her that I guess I wanted the world to see was the woman that I knew. And that's reflected in the film that I made on her. But it's also the basis of that poem. And I've always felt like she was talking to my father. My mother and father got married when she was very young, and he wasn't that old. And they went through 26 years together and did a lot of evolving and changing. And I feel like that poem is reflective of her journey, her internal journey, to the place that she feels now she is her own thing. I love that. It's been inspirational for me as a woman.
How did your mother, when she was the professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, she was a Black woman, a Black woman poet, a Black woman scholar at this highly ranked, predominantly white public university or institution back in the 1970s. That was when the nation was just turning the page on being a segregated Jim Crow America and trying to flip that page and come into a new time period when the country would try to unfold some strategy or some method for creating a desegregated and integrated society. What were her thoughts about this whole process at that time? I'm sure that you all had many discussions about it. What do you recall?
You know, I don't, what I recall might not have even been a discussion. It might be just more, again, watching somebody move through this world. So again, you know, my mom was from Nashville, segregated Nashville, Tennessee. I didn't realize this as a kid, but later as I was doing research for a project, we came to California in the 50s, in about 57, 56 or 57. And it was segregated. And when it was time for me to go to college, actually, when my two older brothers went to school, she sent them to Nashville as well, and then me to Fisk. So I'm saying that to say that her whole life picture has been this balance between segregated American life and finding opportunity within it. But I think it's her experience as a professor all the way through in all the institutions. She would get someplace and almost, you know, attract Black students and their allies,
correct,
but particularly Black students, and almost be a safe zone for them. I think that is, you know, she kind of launched her academic career at Merritt College here in Oakland, the old Grove Street Merritt, where Huey Newton and all of them were going to school. And, you know, I'm very careful. I wasn't even in town, so I'm not making any proclamations about who did what. But I do know that her presence on the campus, it made a home for Black students. And what we find out is that soon after that, the Peralta system closed that campus down and moved that campus up into the hills. So in the original place, it was very accessible. And when Black kids started accessing it, that became problematic. But also the people that were there were clear that this was a time when Black folks needed to tell their own stories. So when she would do a history class, the history would involve a play that would take you all the way back, you know, to life in Africa, the transatlantic. I mean, you know, she would put you physically into the history that she was teaching. And that does a lot for everyone. We get to, you know, go beyond the word on the page into our heart And I always felt like as a professor, that's what she did.
Well, you know, that reflects her skill and knowledge of how to teach, simply because everyone has a different learning style. And for many, that ability, that opportunity to go, as you say, beyond the words on the page is critical to their learning. Speaking of your mother and her expertise as a scholar, you know, she was, and you mentioned history as well, she was a literary historian. And so she had well-defined views about African-American literature. For example, she had a specific perspective about the why of African-American literature. Let's take a moment to listen to hear what she has to say about why African-American literature was absolutely necessary.
When a national literature leaves one out, then a role becomes that of putting one in. And Leroy Jones, Amir Baraka, in a foreword to Black Fire said about Black literature, look in, find yourself. Find the being, the speaker, the voice. We are presenting your various selves. We are presenting from God, a tone your own.
Carol, what are your comments about what we just heard?
You know, I love that.
Okay.
So as a kid in an elementary school that was all white, they did not want us there. I was struggling with reading. And in the fourth grade, I guess I was not hitting the mark. My mother put James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room in my hand. And I read this. Now, I have to say, I'm sure I didn't really understand what I was reading, but I read that book, and that was the end of me feeling like I wasn't a reader. What I did understand from that is that I had a style of reading. So if I today want to read a book, I've got to kind of shut down everything around me and really focus. So that is a learning style. But also, the difference between reading the words of James Baldwin and reading, I don't know what they had us reading then, Dick and Jane or whatever it was. I mean, yeah. I could feel the soul in one and felt completely unattached to the other.
We're not going to try to belabor the point, but to recognize African Americans' exclusion from the nation's literature is to infer that there were and there are significant differences between Black and white writers, you know? And your mother, of course, she wanted to make it clear that those differences are important. I'm going to play now your mother's comments about the difference between Black and white writers.
Take Afro-American poets and the Anglo-Saxon poet. A poet in a traditional society has functions and roles that they play beyond that of putting writing pen to paper. And I would say that whites anyway put their thoughts to pen, and that is writing for them, whereas the African was the composer who put thoughts together. And not only thoughts, but you might have drum, dance, music, ritual, drama, all combined. A friend of mine in East Africa, he was saying, can you put down a poem that includes 1,000 dances? Mm-hmm. And when you can get to a traditional poem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's an important distinction.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. I'm Dr. Brooks Robinson of BlackEconomics.org in Honolulu, Hawaii. Today we're joined by documentary filmmaker, social activist, and executive director of the Sarah Webster Fabio Center for Social Justice in Oakland, California, Ms. Cheryl Fabio. She's sharing her insightful knowledge about her mother, the late great poet and scholar of African-American literature, Professor Sarah Webster Fabio. We are revisiting one of Professor Fabio's many roles while at the University of Wisconsin-Madison as a literary expert for the Literary Corner Black Writers of the World radio program series, which was broadcast during the 1970s. That program is now among the holdings of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C.
Cheryl, your thoughts about the differences between black and white writers?
I agree completely. I think the difference is at its root that one culture believes that it's the written word that is God. The other culture has a communal and an oral tradition behind it. But for me, Black writing all over the world, it first of all has a, I believe, an oratory beginning, but also the stories we're telling are just so, they're just so different. They're so different. The other thing, of course, is that story can be, it can be written, it can be dance, it can be music, it's all of that.
I was talking earlier about African-American History Month and the Literary Corner of Black Writers of the World series, for which your mother, Sarah Webster Fabio, was a literary expert. It turns out that African-American History Month is that great opportunity for people to typically have an opportunity to learn something about African-American literature, the classics. But so often, other times of the year, there's absolutely almost nothing that you hear or see about this great literature that we know as African-American literature. Any thought about why this happens and what we can do to change that?
Well, I certainly have a lot of thoughts about February as being African-American History Month. And one of them is that, you know, this is the history of America. It's not just our history. It's our storytelling. But we didn't do this stuff by ourselves. So for me, I really take a different view. I feel like every day is African American History Day. And I kind of move around the world like that. I'm willing to program if I'm doing a series of films or something. And it doesn't have to be in February. And it could be that the Bay Area, we've been doing this for a while. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I'm going to give us grace. But that there is a lot of conversation about, well, number one, February is a short month. But also, this is American history. Like, get over it and
learn something.
Drink from the well.
Yeah, learn something. Yeah. Okay. I want to move now to your role specifically in trying to keep alive the work of your mother, Professor Sarah Webster Fabio. Can you tell us just a little bit about how you have, since she departed, worked in many ways to keep her work alive? I know about your filmmaking skills and abilities and the great films that you've made, but and also, of course, the Sarah Webster Fabio Center for Social Justice there in Oakland. Talk about those things that you do, the work that you've done to keep the work of Sarah Webster Fabio alive.
Well, I think number one, you have to have a presence. So, I mean, that's the first thing when somebody passes away, is those people who are interested, how do they further that? Especially someone like my mother. So being a woman with raising five children as a single parent, all of the stuff, I would say that her career was on some level truncated. So there's been a lot of queries about her papers and people interested in doing research. So number one, I'm someone who has always tried to make my contact, you know, available so that people who are interested in, well, how do I find out this or that, they can come to me and I can direct them. So that's number one. The second thing is that I am so aware of not only how this approach my mother takes, not only as a professor, but just generally, this approach of do it anyway, you know, just do it.
Speaking of your mother's mantra, just do it. Do you think that would be the kind of mantra she'd be emphasizing and re-emphasizing with the young people of today? What would she be saying to the youth, specifically Black youth today?
You know, I do believe that life is cyclical. So the idea of having, of her having, you know, come from and being trained by a place like Nashville, Tennessee, that story, that just do it thing is something that we've always had to do. And I think that we'll always continue to do. Kind of if you can think it, then do it. If you want it, there's a way. So I think that she would be saying that still. Now, you ask a really interesting question to me.
Okay.
Because before my mother passed away, she had had an auto accident. And I was in film school. She wanted me to make this film. And I said, well, yeah, Mom, but you know, her arm was broken. Her mouth was wired closed. I said, but you have to heal. Well, she took it seriously. She spent, I don't remember, but maybe about 6 months healing and then came out in a way that I thought, whoa, and recording these albums, because recording these albums was acknowledgement that the future was not going to live just in books alone. She knew that it was becoming, that it was going to be words off the page and also into analog. And eventually, I think she knew that there was a digital revolution. So she could see it coming. And I do think that she prepped as best she could to be here with us today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for all of those comments. I will just say that as we have been discussing Sarah Webster Fabio, we're thinking about her, but we're also thinking about African-American History Month and how this program can create a kind of keen interest in your mother's work, Professor Sarah Webster Fabio's work, and in African-American literature broadly. And now you picked it up. And you've carried her life forward, including, as you say, making that documentary film and now operating the Center for Social Justice there in Oakland, California. Let's talk, if you don't mind, just a couple of minutes about that center and what you're doing there.
Well, our center is, I call it aspirational. We're still working towards getting brick and mortar. In the meantime, it's operating out of my house. We are, because I'm a filmmaker, that the primary product is some films, and we've done some really great programs for Oakland, for African Americans in Oakland. But in addition to that, we are fiscal sponsors for other groups that haven't decided to be a 501c3. But also we carry that mantra of just do it. So whether it's a film festival, a film series that we need to do or conversations. You know, one of the things that I thought about is if you're researching my mom, the Black World magazine, there's so many documents in her, not documents, but
essays, publications,
publications, anthologies, where you really have a rich conversation about all things African-American, whether it's literature, if it's the politics of the moment. I mean, that was such a rich time of exchange. And I'm often looking, how can we bring some of that back where we're in community discussing our own selves? You know, our own literature, our own politics, our own films. Who is it that's telling us which films we need to watch? That's sort of, that's
control,
a mission.
Control.
Unstated mission for the Sarah Webster Fabio Center for Social Justice.
Yeah, it is important that African Americans gain the opportunity again to control in a more significant way. At least this is my view of our communities where we live.
Right.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Cheryl Fabio, Executive Director of the Sarah Webster Fabio Center for Social Justice in Oakland, California, documentary filmmaker and social activist. It's been our pleasure to have you on this program, this Sprouts program today. You are certainly a wealth of knowledge about your mother, the great late poet and scholar of African-American literature, Professor Sarah Webster Fabio. Thank you so much for coming and agreeing to participate in this program today. We really appreciate you being on the Sprouts program.
Thank you, Brooks. I'm so glad to have been here.
It's only fitting and right that we conclude this program by giving Sarah Webster Fabio the final word. Let's listen to a wonderful poem that she wrote during the 1960s in memory of her grandmother. It's entitled, Sassafras Tone, My Grandmother Sat.
Stolidly silent, squaw-like, 30 years past her promised 80. Despair, depression, death, dismissed with a nod and a whispered prayer, the Lord giveth and taketh. Her silences were broken usually with proverbs and metaphor. Pretty is, she'd say, is as pretty does, and that was her favorite yardstick to squelch easy praise. Her words so sparse became precious. Quarrels were beyond her, and having entered one, she soon gave the final word. I'm going to lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. I'd play for her time and time again on the pianos of my childhood. And often I'd wonder how she'd manage that in Tennessee, where rivers were sparse, and was sure she'd tripped herself into a fatal lie. But then, when time came snowing down to claim her that winter, she gave up her world in a quiet room overlooking the red clay-muddied waters of the Cumberland. Down by the riverside, down by the riverside, to study war no more.
And that's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to a program about the late great poet and scholar of African-American literature, Professor Sarah Webster Fabio, in one of her many roles at the University of Wisconsin-Madison as a literary expert for the Literary Corner Black Writers of the World radio program series that was broadcast during the 1970s. That program is now among the holdings of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to hear more about Professor Sarah Fabio and African American and African literature, then you're invited to visit thepacificanetwork.org and enjoy the full 25-part radio program series, The Literary Corner, Black Writers of the World. Special thanks to our special guests, the daughter of Professor Sarah Webster Fabio, Ms. Cheryl Fabio, who is a documentary filmmaker, social justice activist, and executive director of the Sarah Webster Fabio Center for Social Justice in Oakland, California. Production assistance for this program came from Stephanie Schubert of Pacifica Radio. Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you'd like to showcase globally on Sprouts, then contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at email address ursula@pacifica.org. That's the letters ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Dr. Brooks Robinson in Honolulu, Hawaii. Thank you so very much for listening.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things.
Welcome to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your co-host Eleanor Goldfield along with Mickey Huff. First up this week, Mexico City-based journalist José Luis Granado Ceja joins the show to talk about the recent Mexican operation that captured and killed a notorious cartel kingpin, and how U.S. corporate media is twisting this story to not only give the U.S. undue credit, but to further the dangerous and dehumanizing rhetoric of Mexicans as villains. José Luis also digs into Mexico-U.S. relations and how regional solidarity is needed in order to address the violent grandstanding by the U.S. Next up, my co-host Mickey Huff sits down with media analyst Nolan Higdon again to dig into the latest in the Epstein file.